Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night. I'm Hunter, joined as always by Brody and Silas.
I'm back
in studio this week.
Thank you.
Weren't there last week. Back this week. We just have to adjust our filming schedule to fit Silas in so he can be here.
It's called Debate Night, so it does look like it's nighttime out, so that works.
It does. There you go. Well, Brody's filming this very early to make sure Silas can be here. Next week you'll be on the East Coast, so it won't be, if we do it again this time, it won't be as bad.
Yeah, you won't be there yet, will you?
No, I think I'm talking to Trevor and to Liz to see, am I going just the final day, day tripping it, or I'm trying to convince Liz to go down with me like Friday, or either Friday or Saturday to be there the last, because I think it's Saturday, Sunday is the last 2 days at USDGC.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of be there the last like 2 days, so either 2 days one night or 3 days two nights. I'm trying to convince Liz to do that, but she's worried, probably rightfully so, about taking a baby to the disc golf tournament. So
You don't want to be that guy.
The thing to think about as well is that I know they have like that spectator thing on Monday, the day after, to where they let fans play the course.
Yeah.
So that would be the question too, is like, could we film something on Monday?
Oh, could we like get the spectator appreciation day and film there?
Yeah. So you guys maybe you get some content at the course. I don't know.
Something to talk about. We're definitely going to try to make a video happen with you and Ezra at the tour championship.
Yeah, we got to figure that out timing wise.
Worst case scenario, which this isn't even that bad case of scenario, is will Trevor and I and Connor will just a day trip it down there, because it's like a little over 3 hours, almost four. But if we left at like 5-6 in the morning, we get down there around 9 or 10 and then get a video in, some type of doubles battle or something, and then be back here by like 5 or 6 at night. So it really wouldn't be that bad of a day.
Yeah.
We had to do that. But and then I'll probably day trip the tour championship finale too, because I want to watch it. I've never seen the tour championship in person.
Yeah, and Kelsey will either, I'm not sure yet, because that's an iffy one, because it's like, why would she want to fly in to see the tour championship if I'm not playing?
Yeah.
And it's like, I have
but
to
then
go
if
through,
you were playing,
it'd be sick. Yeah, yeah, it'd be awesome. So that might be like a last minute change her flight, because I think we're probably just going to have her fly into Lynchburg for the Battle for Bedford.
Yeah.
At some point. So I got to look at flights anyways. I mean, looked at any of that stuff. So
makes sense.
It's going to be a busy next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Finishing out the season. The season's officially about to be over. Only
some
two season, more real
yeah,
events.
Some people's seasons were done after
MVP.
Yeah,
they're over.
Yeah.
Some people's season were over at GMC. Speaking of the tour championship, though, and with Maple Hill, because obviously we'll talk through your Maple Hill tournament, but while we're talking about the tour championship, you jumped up from the play-in event into the actual, you made the cut. So you don't have to do the play-in event. You're going to be playing the first day guaranteed. Was that something like, throughout all the rounds, were you aware of like where you needed to be and that was something you were paying attention to? Or was it just like, play as good as I can, see where I end up?
So GMC was like, play as good as you can, see where you end up. But like going into Sunday, I knew I had to play well to gain any sort of points over people. And then MVP, I could see, you know, I would check at the end of each round.
Yeah, because they were updating it.
Because they were updating at the end of the round. So I could kind of see like, okay, I'm ahead of this person, behind this person. But MVP was so wild because there were so many people that were below that 30 mark that played really well.
Yeah.
So they were getting an insane amount of points, you know, 100 points, 80 points, and were jumping up a lot of people. So on the final day, I wasn't doing math until like hole 17, because it was, unfortunately, they don't update.
It wasn't live.
Like that would have been, nuts if they were making those things go live as play was happening. So I was basically just looking at who was like the four people directly below me and like who were like the four people directly above me. And I was just trying to do the math in my head of like, okay, I've got this person by 20 points and if I was ahead of them of the leaderboard, then it was easy. It's like, all right, I'm still going to stay ahead of them. But it's the tricky thing of like the people that were ahead of me going into round four, but I was now ahead of them on the leaderboard, trying to figure out like, okay, their points are going to drop, mine are going to go up. Is that enough for me to pass? So the only thing that ever really affected was hole 18. We looked at the leaderboard too and saw that if I birdied hole 18, I think I would jump up. I think I would jump a spot. Like I'd go from 21st to 20th. Like there weren't a crazy amount of people at five under at the time. Now, obviously I think some people ended up falling back maybe to five. I don't really know what ended up. I got to pull up the leaderboard to see kind of how that ended up shaking out. But it was one of those situations where my drive wasn't the greatest on 18. I could have gone for it, but the risk of bogeying that hole, because pretty much if you go OB, it's, I would say, like a 90% guarantee bogey. Because, I mean, some people made the drop zone putt. We saw Ricky make the drop zone putt to save his par. Some people did make the drop zone putt, but it was pretty unlikely. So it's like dropping from 4 under to 3 under, I think, was way worse than the benefit of going from 4 under to 5. So I played that hole. Well, the way it shook out, 5 under would have got me a top 20, which would have been actually kind of nice. But I mean, I should have birdied 17. I butchered my upshot on 17. So I can look elsewhere at getting the 5 under.
Got that stroke.
Yeah, I don't think it was worth the risk on 18 to go for it. So. But yeah, no, I was definitely aware of it. It's just the way that they had it. It was difficult to 100% know how it was going to all shake out. And like someone like Thomas Gilbert, for example, he was someone that coming into the day was on lead card and was in like second or third or something. And so his points were, he had a crazy amount of points coming into the day. And it was, you know, he didn't have the greatest round. So he like was kind of dropping down leaderboard. So like, it was difficult to kind of be like, okay, he did have 100 points, but now like that's where I think maybe in the future, they probably will do that live. Cause I mean, I don't think it's going to be too terribly difficult if they're able to update it at the end of the day. I'm sure they'll figure out how to do it kind of as scores are coming in on UDisc.
Yeah.
And then I think too, that would be pretty exciting for the, because I did live pull that up a lot throughout the round.
So most of the tournament, they just used kind of like after yesterday's round, this is the standings. But as it came down the stretch, it was like a deciding factor between Ricky and Paul for who was going to win.
I know.
The
I
points.
Saw that at the very, very
that
end.
They did live. Like they were talking about like, these
how
different
it
scenarios.
Out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but for most of it, they didn't. And I think it's because Trevor made a good point. The points for the very top didn't matter unless it's like between Ricky and Paul, or if it's someone jumping to a semifinal or not. But like the thrilling part was like people getting out of the play-in event or getting into the play-in event. Like Thomas Gilbert got into the play-in event. In those storylines,
I know they were talking about
the players,
him.
Like, yeah, they were talking about him for sure, but a lot like of the players like, on the bubble weren't on coverage. So it was like it was a tough storyline to really create because it's like
you're not
by the time
them.
Coverage is starting, some of the guys were either already done or they're like halfway into their round and they're not having a camera on them because like it is a storyline, but it's not really what people are paying to see. So it's a weird one because and I think it's just the format makes it – the format for the Tour Championship is a very exciting format. But it does just kind of make it where the points aren't nearly as important at the top as it is just making it into the Tour Championship, in my opinion. Even for you, like getting, is there any benefit being in 27th versus being in 30th? Like both are past the play-in event, both are in the actual event. Is there
no,
any
I think
benefit?
If you're just, no, if you're, if I was anywhere in between 30th and, what is it, 21st
17th.
Or something?
17th to 30th, just say qualified.
Okay, 17th. Yeah, wow. That's wow. Okay. Yeah, no.
100. You could have got 123 more points this season and still be just qualified.
Yeah, no. It's just getting into that first, I mean, for me, that was the jump. I knew I couldn't, even if I won, I wasn't going to jump up into the, quarterfinals, I guess, would be the next group. Yeah, I knew I wasn't going to jump up into that. So for me, it was just getting out of that play-in and qualifying without having to do another qualifier, essentially, to get into the Tour Championship. So
yeah,
that was huge.
That is big, very big, because now you're going to have 31st through 36, which Nico's in that group, so he's out, but obviously Eagle has a spot if he takes it. Last he talked, he was just saying he was just playing USDGC, so I don't know if he's playing the Tour Championship or not, which if he doesn't and Nico doesn't, then Jake Ebenheimer is the next one in. But you basically have six guys, regardless, vying for two spots on that play-in day. So that would be a very stressful situation to show up to Charlotte and know, hey, there's a chance I don't get out of it. And one of the guys you're going against is Jeremy Colling, who probably helped design Nevin in some way, shape, or form. So that's, you know, always going to be a tough one to get out of there. But now, last week you hadn't played Maple Hill without the fog. So you were talking about how great it was, but you were like, it was kind of frustrating because I couldn't see it. So now you've had chances to play Maple Hill in some pretty bad weather, looked like some pretty good weather, and obviously with no fog. So what's your now assessment post-tournament of the course?
I mean, yeah, I think I said how, you know, there was a lot of, it's similar to GMC of where there is a lot of hype. And
yeah,
I think I said this in a Twitter video of where that's just a common thing with golf, whether it's disc golf or ball golf, if you will. There I said it, of where people just hype up their courses. Like the local people hype up their courses and, you know, always try to get you to come out and play and always talk about, like, you know, the word hidden gem gets thrown around a lot in golf of where, oh, you got to check this out. No one ever talks about it. It's a hidden gem. And I've, you know, some of them pan out and you're like, wow, this is a really good golf course. And then some are just like, this was kind of overhyped. That happens as well in disc golf, you know, where you hear people talk all about this course. You got to come out. And then you get there and you're like, yeah, it wasn't really that great. GMC and Maple Hill are probably the two courses that have been hyped as much as any other courses, and they live up to it. You know, I think Maple Hill especially is a course that, with how many different tee pads they have, with how many different pins, basket locations they have, you could spend all day out there and not get tired of playing it. You know, you can play all different types of layouts and practice all different types of shots. And that's the one, that's where I was like, man, like this would be like the ideal course for Worlds, in my opinion. Now they can't host, I don't think they can host Worlds because of parking and all this other stuff they were talking about. There were a lot of people out there, but the course itself has a great, the only thing it might be missing is some forehand holes. There's only a handful of maybe one or two holes that like a forehand is like the intended shot, I would say. But that's pretty much it. I mean, it has a good mixture of open holes where I'm throwing nukes off the tee. It has a mixture of good holes where you're throwing putters or mids off the tee. It has some par fours that are like very placement off the drive, other par fours where you're just trying to get it out there as far as possible, but staying in bounds. A great finishing group. Hole 17 is a pretty soft par four. I wonder if they will end up doing something differently there, but hole 16 is a great par three. And then obviously hole 18 is a great finishing hole, where you have to make that decision coming in at the end. And we saw how that worked out for FPO and MPO. Both of them kind of came down to that final hole. So yeah, I think overall it's an awesome course. Definitely looking forward. Like, that's a tournament that, you know, I definitely want to get into again next year, with it probably being in the playoffs. The other thing I'll say about it is, like, the environment, it was probably the best environment out of any tournament stop we've had. it was definitely the closest. It definitely felt the closest to a tour event in golf. With a lot of times you go Des Moines up there. There's a couple that are up there too. Like Des Moines is up there. You know, Country Club, you had some people posting up on hole 16. There's a couple other courses that have people that just like post up on holes. And to me, like that, I think is the difference. Like will be the difference in the atmosphere is where you have a couple thousand people out there, but hundreds of people are just posted up on hole 5. Hundreds of people are posted up on hole 17. Hundreds of people are posted up on hole 10. And so what ends up happening is you have people watching the chase card, lead card, and then people watching all these other holes. You just hear the roars constantly throughout the day, and they're coming from all over the course. And, you know, leading up to hole 8, you could start hearing it from hole 3, essentially.
Wow.
Is when you, I mean, really, you could hear it really almost from the basket of hole 1. But from hole 3's basket on, you can start hearing hole 8. And so, like, that's kind of cool hearing that as you're approaching it. And even hole 14 was nuts. There was a lot. They had bleachers, two sets of bleachers on hole 14 that were pretty much packed all week. So that it was really the first time you really felt like there was like a full crowd almost out there. And it was, it changes. It makes it definitely different.
That's pretty sick. Now because like the 8 holes, they had some scrutiny.
Partially yeah, I saw that from some people.
Also from Nate Sexton on coverage. As a player, because like the biggest thing Sexton brought up, and I think this is the most valid point, was when lead card got to hole 8, they did like their intros. It's raining at that time, and it held up the lead card. So Corey Ellis is just standing on the tee pad with his disc in the pouring rain while they announce the lead card names and stuff like that. And Nate was like, I'm all for like the rowdiness and stuff like that, but like when you're disrupting the flow, and like Corey at this point was having a bad round, and he was like, when you're disrupting the flow and now you're making someone just who wants to just like start getting his round going, get through this thing, has to just stand there in the rain on hole 8 because the crowd wants to announce his name. He's like, I think that's kind of gone too far, is more or less what Nate Sexton was saying. As a player, though, did you feel that at all? Like, was that something that was still happening on your card, or was that something like the theatrics weren't until the camera got there, or like,
no, they
what
did
was
that
your experience with it?
So essentially what I think was going on was I think they did this on hole 14 as well. Cause I heard it on hole 14. I think what they were doing was they were announcing, and maybe when the cameras got there for Lee Card, it was maybe built up a little bit more. Cause I think I even saw them like on the green.
Yes.
Like people were coming on the green to do it.
Yes.
With like over the border, which
that's what I said. Keep it behind the border.
Yeah. I don't think we should be allowing anyone to come on the green, but they were doing it on hole 14 as well. And I think essentially what they're doing is, you know, we don't have, when you go to a disc golf pro tour, you don't have a, what do they call those? Pamphlet? No. I mean, it is a pamphlet, but there's a word for them of where, like, it basically, if you go to a PGA Tour event, you can just grab one of these things and it'll literally have all the tee times on there. So when you get to a hole and you see a group come in, you can match up them and be like, oh, okay, the next group coming in is going to be this. The next group's going to come in is this. And I think essentially that's all they were doing, right? Is they were just announcing who was about to be throwing. Now, when they did it for my group all 4 days on hole 13, on hole, it might have gotten a little bit more juiced the final day, but the previous days, it was pretty much while we were walking, because it's a little bit of a walk from hole 7 to 8. While we were walking from hole 7 to 8 is when they did it. I think hole 8, I think you might be right. I think I might have been the first one to throw. And I think I did have to wait a little bit because I think they were finishing when I was on the tee pad. Where I want to say the previous days, they were already done before we even got to the tee pad. Like we were still walking from hole 7 to 8 and they had already announced who was about to throw. Yeah. Hole 14, I think I might have had to wait we had to wait maybe one of the days too. I know they were doing like some like clap thing too. And I was curious actually, because I saw people on social media like hitting me up saying, hey, what'd you think about hole eight and the crowd and stuff? And I was trying to think like, what, like, were people upset with like the cheering? Were people upset with them clapping? Like, I was trying to think what it was, because to me, like, the noise, like, I want that. I want roars happening all over the place. But yeah, I agree with Nate there. I didn't, I guess when I was watching coverage, I really wasn't, at that point, I really wasn't paying maybe the greatest attention to what was going on. So that's why I was like vaguely like, was there someone like on the green or whatnot? So yeah, I mean, I don't think we should be having spectators, no matter who they are, like on the green, basically stopping the flow. And like you said too, I think there's a time and place for like making that announcement. I don't think you should be making that announcement like you're on hole one where everyone has to wait for it. But the energy on hole eight, like, I don't want that to change. I think that was incredible. I could see too. Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying, like, it's a tough one, because like they've gotten, I'll say, better every year. Like, they've gotten louder, rowdier. They figured out different things every year, and it's become more and more of a thing. This was the first year, to me at least, where it started to feel more, at least from how the cameras captured it, felt more like a production of like, look at us, the spectators, were the eight holes, versus being there to cheer on the card coming in, if that made sense. So like, there was they literally did a flag show for when the guy landed safe, and I'm like that type of stuff I felt like was just one step too far. The announcing, the flag show, stuff like that. Like, I'm all for being as loud and as rowdy as possible behind in the stands. Like, I think that's incredible. And like, that's the stigma that got the eight holes where they're at, is like, that's kind of like the loudest hole in golf. That's the loudest hole in disc golf in many ways. Other areas have copy and pasted it, right? But that's the one that started it. And I think that's what I liked about it on coverage, was like, I love, even on this coverage, I loved when people were putting, you could hear it. Even on coverage, people were on 5, 6, 7, you could hear it. And then you get to hole eight and you know, like, it's going to be a pretty electric atmosphere there. But I feel like from the coverage, it just seemed like it went one step too far. So I was curious on the ground and as a player, if that was at all what you had going from it.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing with the flags too is it is one of those where, do we need a green flag when it is very obvious that it's green? So that's something that I've always, as a player, that's something that I've always questioned, of where, you know, whole, I mean, there's so many holes that it happens at, of where you have spotters out there with a red and a green flag. And especially on holes that are kind of blind, of where like the spotter's like hiding. And so the spotter has to like run out to show you whether you're in or out. When it's like clearly the disc is in bounds, do people like to see, like you said, like the flag show, of where someone throws it underneath the basket? Should we have people running around the green with green flags?
Absolutely not. Or
does everyone just get super excited? And then if someone does throw OB, or, because again, like, do you need to, if someone on that hole, for example, if someone chucks it and it goes 15 feet short, splashes, do you need the red flag?
No.
So yeah, there, you know, I love spotters. We need spotters. And I would say the majority of time, this is what I think spotters are the best at. These are the two things that I think they come, well, three things actually. These are the three things that are super important. And this is why we need volunteers. We need spotters. And if we didn't, I think the fairness almost of the competition kind of goes down and the luck kind of goes up. So the first one obviously is like, some of these holes, it's hard to tell when we can throw, of when, when the group in front of us is actually clear. Like, hole nine is a perfect example. It's a blind shot up and over the hill. If someone is struggling on that hole, it's very hard. We can't tell that someone's struggling up there and it's still on the fairway. So having someone there with a red flag to let us know, like, don't throw yet, super crucial. We need that. The other thing we need is spotters to simply do exactly what that is, spot. Find where the disc ended up, because that's a huge pace of play thing. You know, we're chucking discs into Christmas trees. Sometimes they stick up into Christmas trees. Sometimes they go underneath some brush, and it's going to be a lot harder from someone 500 feet away to try to locate that disc than having someone already down there and be like, boom, the disc land right there, run over, find it, put a little flag. So when we come up, and they were doing that on even shots in the fairway, they were putting little flags there. And that was so huge because, again, unless we're playing on golf courses where the grass is super, super short, even if your disc lands in the fairway, it still takes 10, 15 seconds sometimes to be like, okay, because, you know, the grass is long enough to where sometimes you can walk right by it. So yeah, they were doing that in the fairway, off the fairway, and that saves so much time and helps the pace of play so much. And then the last thing I would say for, like, and this goes to, like, kind of the fairness of it, is being able to locate where the disc was last in bounds. That's another huge one, because there's so many holes where it's very difficult from our perspective with how the discs travel to be able to tell if it crossed or didn't cross, and having someone already down there to be like, oh no, it definitely crossed right here, or nope, it never crossed. Like, that is super, super useful and super helpful. So there's three, in my opinion, those three things are massive. The fourth one, them throwing up a red or green flag of whether we're OB or not, my opinion, that only comes into play when there's like a drop zone of when, if we, or when there's either a drop zone or if it's a scenario of did I ever cross? Because if I walk all the way up and I'm like, oh, my disc is actually OB, now I have to go all the way back to throw my shot. That's not good. Those are the only scenarios that the red or green flag makes sense for me. So, like, in my opinion, hole eight, you don't need, and again, some people can argue and say, I love it, it looks great. If that's your argument of where you love the entertainment side of it, that's fine. I'm talking about just the practical side of it. We don't need red or green flags on hole eight.
Yeah, because even if you are OB on hole eight, you're still walking past the green. Right?
You're going to the putt. Yeah, you're going to the the putting drop zone. Yeah, so you're already walking up there.
Yeah, even if it's like a questionable, like, kind of on the line, you're probably going to walk up and take a look at your lie anyways, even if you get the red flag before you walk up there. So
correct. Yeah, so you're not saving any time there. So that's a hole where practically, on the practical side, you do not need red or green flags.
No, I think it makes sense. Yeah, I mean, Simon in his like victory speech, whatever you want to call it, talked about how good the spotters were out there and how much it helped the pace of play, because he said there wasn't a single backup out there that he experienced.
Well, round one, we got a lost disc on hole three. Luke Humphreys
really
threw a shot. I mean, there's a lot of leaves on the ground, and there was no spotter on hole three, and we got up there and looked around for 3 minutes. There was probably like 10 of us looking around, and we had a good idea of like where it went, and we just could not find it. It was probably buried under some leaves, and that's a scenario where that could have saved them a shot or two if there was a spotter. So they are crucial, and the holes that they were on, very beneficial.
Yeah, the flagging in the fairway, even, that's a great point. I think that's something that a lot of tournaments don't really do, at least in my experience. And that's something that if you are running like a local tournament and trying to make it as good as possible, that's something that's, you know, if you have volunteers, easy to add. Like if you put them on a long par four and just tell them like, hey, every shot that lands around here, flag it. That'd probably, I can see definitely where that would be very beneficial. You just walk up, you see the four flags, you know, oh, there's our four shots. No looking for it at all. Stuff like that's where Maple Hill always seems to be on top of things. It's kind of like, I always look at Maple Hill and USDGC as the two tournaments that implement things that are going to be everywhere in the sport in a few years, to where like they have these ideas of and a lot of it they take from other sports, like bleachering hole 8, sounds like bleachering hole 14, where they'll do it first, and then you'll see other tour stops slowly add it. They'll also do like the spotter thing. They'll do different things with payout, the ace challenge this weekend, which no one hit, but the $1 million ace challenge, you know, USDGC Shocker. With different OB things and stuff. Yeah. I mean, I think that's stuff where you see Maple Hill and USDGC, which it kind of is funny. They're back to back this year, push the sport forward in a lot of ways and sometimes push it too far in the wrong direction or whatever and gets pushed back, but they're willing to test things and they're willing to throw stuff out there and then get feedback from players, get feedback from the fans, and then stuff that's really, really well received just turns into like the industry standard of the sport. So I always get really excited when we're going to Maple Hill or USDGC because I think the people who run that always are forward thinking and they're always like a glimpse into like, this is possibly what the future of our sport looks like in a lot of ways. And so I think weekends like this, it's always great when you're like, yeah, this was all incredible. I wish we had this everywhere. And it's like, well, probably a year or two from now, you will have it everywhere.
Yeah. One thing too, that I thought was really cool was the advertising wall behind hole 8.
Yeah.
I think that is now, can every course do that? I don't know, but to me, instead of the pro tour, what they're basically doing right now is the pro tour is kind of walking, you know, driving around with all their advertising assets and they're setting them up on the course. In my opinion, they look way worse than like that wall in hole 8 that, you know, OTB was able to put their marketing and stuff behind. So like, is that the future? Is it the future of like either, cause that's, to me, that wall is going to stay there, right? They're not taking that wall out for casual play.
I think it's normally just like a blank wood wall. Yeah.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
They're taking obviously the advertisements out, but like the wall itself is still going to stay there. Like, is that also potentially the future of disc golf courses on tour of where they build stuff in like that? So when the pro tour does come to town, the pro tour, instead of having like these, you know, signs that they just set on the ground that honestly don't look that great, or even like the banner flags that they sometimes put like really close to the tee pad that I don't think look that great. Like, what if like hole one just has a huge, like kind of three-sided wall covering hole one that you can then throw advertisements in the wall. Mm-hmm. And so like the pro tour, instead of having assets that like they have to like set up, they just basically have like the advertising walls that they can just insert in as they kind of go. I just thought that looked really professional and looked really clean.
I agree.
Now hole 14, I don't know if they talked about it at all in the broadcast or whatnot. If you guys saw it, like hole 14 is like the opposite where they had the pro tours, like, little wall thing, and like that wall was changing throughout the day. Like, we got up to it when we played it in round three or something, and one of the wall features was like slanted like this. Ezra missed his putt and it was like headed down towards the water, and it almost, because the wall was like slanted, it almost like ramped up over the wall. Where other people were playing it earlier in the day, it was down like this. So there was no way that was going to ramp up and over. So like, that's a scenario where it's like, all right, if we're going to say these things are part of the course, which I think is another, we need to stop doing that, because hole 16, it happened to me and Colton the final day, and I'm sure it happened to tons of other people, where you're putting these signs in on the course. These are not like, these signs are not part of the course. Like, we should not be having to straddle putts, or the other thing with the banners, right? The feather banners. We should not be having to like try to throw shots through feather banners that are put on the course as like advertising assets. That, I think hopefully that is something they look at in the off season of like, okay, what does part of the course actually mean? And in their opinion, part of the course is not, well, if it was there before the tournament started, that's part of the course. Like, if the pro tour comes in and throws assets, throws trash cans, throws porta potties, throws stuff like that, my opinion, that is not part of the course. right? We don't want people playing out of a food vendor's tent, essentially. Now, there are certain scenarios where you see in golf where like guys are like hitting shots off of like balconies and stuff in the tents and stuff that they have set up. I think they can get relief there and they choose like, this is going to be a better shot if I just hit it right off of this than getting relief. And they did something kind of like that, similar to 14, which I think is cool, of where like hole 14, they have those bleachers behind. They didn't say you get relief back, which I think you should be able to. Like if you want to get relief, if you throw it into the bleachers, I feel like you should be able to get relief behind the bleachers, no closer to the hole, but behind the bleachers and putt from back there if you want. But the thing I thought that was cool was like, if you throw in the bleachers, they basically told us that we have to play on top of the bleachers, which is kind of a cool thing if you want to do that. But I think you also should have the option. And my thing is like, if you throw a shot up against one of these walls and signs and all that stuff, we should not be having awkward footing, you know, with a sign in between us. I think it looks weird. One and two, like, I don't know if that actually happened on live coverage, but I think that's something that they need to definitely take into place, because there are courses we play where this comes into play more. And I just don't think it looks good when we're having to throw shots around advertising assets.
No, I agree. I mean, I got a question, at least one of the things you said. So the walls and the feather banners fully make sense to me, because like if I'm on the wall, I can like take it out of the ground, lay it down, throw, putt, whatever, and stick it back up. Is that more what you're saying? Because then that's not the same solution as like porta potties, food vendor tents, bleachers.
Though, yeah. So the wall, when it's something simple as that, and how golf does it, like if the spectator rope, right?
Yeah.
If your ball lands right below the spectator rope, in golf, to where now if you take a swing, your swing's going to be in the spectator rope. They don't want that to happen. That looks bad and that looks weird. So they literally do what you just said, pull up the stakes of the spectator rope, lay the rope on the ground, and now they can take a swing and then they put it right back.
Yeah.
That's probably what you would do with like the walls, right? Instead of like having your disc up against the wall and being like, I have no run up now, or I have to do like a hurdle over this wall to throw, like lift the wall up, set it down, throw your shot, put the wall back. Now, when it comes to these other things like porta potties, trash cans, food vendors, that's where I think you got to take relief off of it. No closer to the hole.
They're just casual. They're just like casual relief areas, essentially.
Yeah. Do we want on live coverage someone throwing a shot right next to a porta potty? Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably looks weird. You would take casual relief like in the line to the hole, to where that is no longer. Basically what you would do is you would make it to where you go to your first, I believe you go to the first point of where you have like line of sight with the basket, where the porta potty or food vendor or whatever isn't in your line of sight. And then you can go back as far as you want on that line, essentially, I think is how it would be. But yeah, these are just things that we haven't really gotten that bad. There hasn't been a spot on live where like something like this has happened and you're just like, oh my gosh, this looks terrible. But we're not far off from it happening. And I hope in the off season they fix it to where it doesn't happen and then they fix it, kind of thing. Like kind of fix the problem before
like
it's
be
a
proactive.
Problem.
Yeah. Fix it before someone's opening the door of a porta john and throw them with their foot in the toilet.
Yes.
Essentially. Now, next weekend or next week is USDGC. Obviously, you're in Texas now. When are you headed over there?
Probably going to look into flights this morning, but I think Thursday would probably be the thing. I think we're going to try to do we're going to do obviously a practice round, film that out there. And then we might have two pretty big doubles matches happening.
Nice. I saw Ricky and Corey Ellis challenging your last one, right?
Yeah. So that's an interesting one. We tried to get them earlier in the year, and I don't know exactly what happened, but we didn't really get a response. So, and I don't even know how it came about. I think we were playing our doubles match when they came up. And I think that led to it being saying like, hey, you know, let us, you know, I was like, hey, let me know if you guys ever want to play, you guys have a spot, we would love to have you kind of thing. And that's what led that conversation, of them, you know, saying, well, like, let's bet for money, yada, yada. So I'm assuming we're playing with them at USCGC. I'm not 100% sure. And then there's another group of two. Well, yeah, there's another doubles that we want to film at USCGC as well. And there's a third one that we're kind of on the fence of whether or not we can pull it off. So we might have three doubles matches going down. But if we get in there
on USCGC.
Yeah, if we get in there on Thursday, though, like, hopefully we can work out with everyone the timing of it, but doubles matches aren't too terrible. Obviously, yeah. It's not like a, and we're not doing anything crazy. We're still playing the course and practicing. So, I've never felt like unprepared.
Yeah.
For a tournament because we're doing a doubles match.
No, yeah, that makes sense. Have you heard of any changes to the USDGC course or anything yet?
Yes.
You have. I haven't yes. looked into it. I'm about to do the preview show next week, so that's when I'll really dig into the course.
Yeah, look into it. So they are combining holes 3 and 4.
Oh, fascinating! That's a cool hole.
They are bringing here. You talk about something real quick, and let me pull it up.
Well, combining, I don't have nothing to talk about. Silas, what are you?
No, you have stuff to talk about.
I haven't been to USDGC.
We gotta get Silas out there.
That'd be cool.
What does Silas shoot?
Silas, do you know the course? Like you know USDGC
a
like,
little bit. I remember seeing it last year.
What would be your guess on what you would shoot relative to par? Don't worry about like actual score.
What is par?
Well, just like plus 10, minus 10. What are you about to shoot?
Probably like a plus 20.
You know, that's respectable. I would say somewhere in that range. That'd probably be pretty accurate. It depends.
Way higher.
It depends on, well, if you're going in and you're like, I just got to get to plus 20, you play that course a lot different.
And what, I mean, Silas could take a 9 on hole 1.
No. Do they change hole 1?
Double Mando.
That's the double you missed, Mando, right?
On it.
You miss the Mando, you keep throwing.
Just throw. Is he laying up short?
I'll just lay up if I'm plus 20.
Yeah, if he's got plus 20, he knows he can bogey every hole.
Yeah.
And there's some holes he'll par out there.
Like?
There's some holes he'll par out there.
like?
What about that triple Mando hole?
That's a birdie or a bogey. For
what?
You. It's a birdie or a bogey for you.
How is that a par hole for you?
Right, I'll just lay up, right?
You could just lay up. I guess if you just like throw like a 100-foot, 200-foot putter shot and then you just have
to You still have to get up and down. But you still have to get up and down. Silas, is your putting a lot better now?
No.
Okay. If your putting was a lot better, then I'd say I'd give you a chance. But if your putting's still iffy.
Plus 20 could be tough for you. That'd be fascinating to see.
I've still never been to a like a pro event.
You never been to a pro event at all?
No.
Jeez. Okay, so
into it in COVID.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
We'll run through the course real quick, and I can just tell you the changes so you can be prepared. So hole 1's the same double Mando hole. Hole 2 is now par 3, so the basket is in the same location, but the tee is like. Those two trees that we're having to throw through, it's offset to the left. So it looks like we're going to have like a little bit of a gap and we're throwing kind of down the right hand side, like
towards that fence, that chain link fence.
Yeah, we're throwing towards the fence. So we're on the left side of the fairway throwing towards the fence. I don't know if there'll be a forehand line there. That might just be a pure backhand. And they have a Mando at the corner now. So you can't even go over
the parking
the
lot.
Road. Yeah. So they're forcing you to throw it through the fence line. So that'll be an interesting change. Hole 3, I'm really excited about. So same tee pad.
Yeah.
But now they're having it go to hole 4's basket.
Okay.
So
the Mando's still in play on 4?
The Mando's still in play on three. Yeah. Hole four's Mando is now still on hole three.
Yes.
So now you're going to have to try to bomb your drive. Bomb your drive to the landing spot of old hole four to give you that angle in to that.
I feel like that's really not too bad.
No, that's a good hole. Now they have hazard. They have hazard. I don't know what. Obviously, they have hazard on where that like mechanical thing is on hole three used to be. That's hazard. But they have like a semicircle coming out of the road. I don't know what that's for. I think that might straight just be them wanting to make the drive harder.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure that's just all grass there.
It is, yeah.
So they have that coming out. So that makes it to where if you do want to get aggressive and try to get a birdie and like clear it all, I don't know how far that clear is, but that's going to be an exciting tee shot throwing from up high like that all the way down there. Hole four, I think they described it as a hole that they used to have. It's a par three, 304 feet. Looks like a dead straight shot. Pretty wooded though, pretty much
like
tree
a tight,
coverage.
Tight tunnel shot, like
yeah, it's after hole four. So after old hole four, you would go to like the right.
Yeah, like where the players' warm up area is between that and the old golf course. Is it?
I think
like
they said that's
tight a tunnel shot.
It looks like it. Yeah.
Ew, I hated that hole.
That hole?
It's fine if it's the hole I'm thinking of.
It is because they said they're bringing it back. They said they're
bringing
it back.
It was just a throw-in hole. Like, it wasn't anything special.
Okay. Hole five looks to be the same. The par five, 1,000-footer. That's going to be always a fun one. Hole six, the beach hole, is the same. Nothing different looks there. Hole seven, the triple Mando hole, looks exactly the same. Hole eight... They did change. No, hole eight's the same. Hole eight's the same.
Nine, they typically change somehow every year.
They made, I don't know if it was OB or hazard last year, but to the right is all hazard this year.
It was all OB last year,
for the tee shot. Just for the tee shot. Your second shot's still OB if you go on like the baseball field.
Yeah.
But for your tee shot, if you go right, you're hazard. So, like, if you go really far right, you are, because that Mando, you're going to be super pinched. Hole nine is the same with the mozzarella sticks, and the drop zone is the same, it looks like. No change there. Hole 10, same. Hole 11. The heck is hole 11?
Used to be the one that was like you just walked across the road, hedges all on the right, all the bushes.
Yeah, hole 11's way different this year.
Okay.
For the hazards. I'll show a photo so you can see.
I see nothing but a ring light.
There you go.
Oh, so they're interesting.
There's like pockets.
So they're like putting that pocket. They've had pockets before, but they're putting that one in the middle of the fairway, I guess, to like make you
no layup.
Yeah,
you can't lay up there.
Be aggressive, or if you lay up, you have to lay up really short.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. We'll see how that one plays out. Hole 12, same thing. Hole 12, very interesting. New OB in the center of the fairway. Hold on.
Oh, that's right at the landing spot.
Yep.
Wow.
Very interesting. So now that's another one where that's right where people were landing. So it's either you got to
landing spot.
You either want to play short or you got to go big over top of that. So that's going to be an interesting change. Hole 13, they're changing that to just a par four. So instead of going to where that was a par five, where it was like short and then we played it sometimes long, it's now just a par four in the landing zone.
So you never go across the parking lot?
Correct. So the people that you were it's not even in the landing zone. That's like a little bit more further away from where you want your second shot to land.
Is it past the tree or short of the tree?
Yeah, past the trees.
Past the tree? Okay.
It's like tucked in there.
It was where people were throwing like their that was their second shot.
No, but it's further down. Your second shot is just past this Mando. Hold on, wait for it to.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It's the second shot is just it's the next row. See that?
I gotcha. Yeah. So you're gonna have to kind of crush with the second shot now to get the birdie.
Yeah, you're gonna have to get one way out there.
I had to go like fairway where people were being able to go mid to get to that first area.
Because even if you throw a 500 foot shot, you still have like 320 in.
Yeah.
So it's probably gonna be like a flex backhand kind of shot into that green. No OB on the left though, so you can kind of get away with it. Hole 14 is exactly the same. Hole 15 looks to be exactly the same. Hole 16, exactly the same. Hole 17, the same with an A and B position.
Yeah.
And then hole 18 is the same. So.
Nice.
Why is this course still here?
Why is it
still here? Why is it on a college campus while we're throwing over baseball fields?
They signed a contract recently. I think we're a few years away from it being gone. What I think is going to happen is I think Innova's going to build. I think Innova's going to build like their dream USDGC. Like this course has a ton of teeth. I think it's going to keep the same feel.
Like a bunch of options.
I think it's going to keep the same feel and still be in the same area. But I think the days at USDG at Winthrop are numbered. If I had to guess.
Yeah. Well, that, and it just, it doesn't look the greatest, you know, playing on a college campus.
Yeah.
They got to,
the U.S. championship.
They got to figure out qualifying too, I think.
Yeah. They still have some kinks to work out with it for sure. But I mean,
the qualifying's still not ironed out that great.
The tough part is, I think it's ironed out how Innova wants it. Well, I don't think it's ironed out for the best way for the players. So
yeah, it's not ironed out for the best way for the players or for the best way for spectators and stuff.
Yeah.
Because who's having, do we have a Monday qualifying list? Do we have a list of people that
is registered?
Is there a way of seeing first ones out or people that weren't able to qualify throughout the year?
You can typically they have like the registration, so you can just see like who's signed
up. People already have tee times, so.
Registered players. So let's just scroll down this list, and I'll read out names. That's impressive. Andrew Fish. Trying to read other. It's all alphabetical. There's some names I know, but I don't know if people know. Like, I don't know how I know their name.
Probably don't mention those people.
You know, I was just trying to think of like.
Oh, David Wiggins.
David Wiggins Jr. Evan Scott, he's popped off at some tour events.
Yeah, he has.
He's on the Monday qualifying list.
I mean, he almost won Mid America.
Johnny McRae,
Nate Perkins,
Silas said. Lance Brown's a tour player.
Scott Stokely,
Luke Callahan beat our butts in a bogey row battle. He's on there. Matt Dollar, I haven't heard that name in a long time. Raven Newsom,
Zach Melton.
Raven just popped off at MVP.
Yeah, Scott Stokely. Let's see. Anyone else down here?
That was Zach Melton.
Zacharias Johnson, Zach Melton. They're on the wait list, actually, so they're not even into Monday qualifying.
Oh. Yikes.
Zacharias Johnson's 14th on the wait list to get into Monday qualifying.
What?
So
how many people are on the qualifying list?
124 are registered.
Oh, my gosh.
124 registered, 17 people on the wait list. Zach Arlingus, Zacharias Johnson, and Zach Melton are the notable names on the wait list. And Silver Lot. He's on the wait list as well.
Holy smokes. So it'll be interesting to see, too, how that all shakes out. Because obviously this year there's probably not as many names. You know, there was, what, 10 or 12 guys?
Yeah, there's not as many names. Only three or four top, like, pretty notable guys.
Yeah.
I would say.
And I think a lot of that has to do with just – more people are like touring this year, so like more people had more chances versus last year. You have some guys that maybe only are playing four or five events, and if they don't pop off in one of those, then they don't qualify. But yeah, I mean, obviously, right now it's still getting all the big names in, essentially, right?
Yeah,
but it's still weird to like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see.
It's more interesting.
We'll see how it plays out.
to me, I feel like with the current structure, how many events they're doing, stuff like that, I feel like they should have them pretty much all be Pro Tour events and then have one or two in Europe. And I think that's fine. Right now, what's weird is they're missing Pro Tour events like DDO and picking random A and B tiers. And it's not like,
well, like MVP wasn't one either. So that,
yeah, it's not like they're picking an A
tier. That would have been a great storyline.
Like, it would have been. It's not like they're picking an A tier and it's like, oh, this is the Canada Nationals. Like, that one makes sense. It's like they're just picking a random B tier in Texas. And it's like, why the heck is that a qualifier? Like, it doesn't make sense for that to be a qualifier when MVP, DDO, some of these other ones aren't qualifiers. Mm-hmm. I don't think D-Glow was either. And it seems to be a pretty easy pattern to sniff out. If it has another manufacturer's name in the title of the event, it's probably not a qualifier. That's kind of the way to go about it. Like, if it's the MVP Open, the Dynamic Disc Open, Discraft's Great Lake Open, probably not a qualifier. So it's not too hard to see the line of thought there. And if you're Innova, why the heck not? Because you're in full control of the event, and you know, if you want to be able to do it, you can. So
here's a question now, based off Innova. Do you think the Las Vegas Challenge will be on the Pro Tour next year?
If it is, it's going to have changes, is my opinion.
Because they already have dates up, which I thought was interesting.
The Las Vegas Challenge does.
Mm-hmm, on their website.
Is it already sanctioned? That'd be the next question.
I'm not sure. I didn't look at that. I just know that dates for the Las Vegas Challenge are already up on their website, and I thought that was very interesting.
That is very interesting. Welcome to Las Vegas Challenge 2023, because like let's see, practice days, formal play February 23rd through 26th. That's something.
Because the other thing is, I know they've talked about doing like the all-star event more in Florida, I think was kind of like the talk, right?
Okay. They talked about moving it some, yeah.
And
it's
I think
Las Vegas Challenge is not PDGA sanctioned yet, so we can't see if it's registered yet, but.
And I know there is definitely chatter about trying to change up the flow of the tour for next year.
Well, I know, because I know there's these swing events happening this year, right? One of them happened in Florida, one of them happened in Virginia at Lake Marshall, which if you happen to be a touring pro listening to this, if you stop by the Battle for Bedford the week before Lake Marshall, then you can just kind of chill in Virginia for 2 weeks after the championship.
Do we have spots open right now?
Is it full? I haven't looked at registration.
I don't know. Last time I looked, there was a ton of people registered.
There are a lot of people registered. I'll give it that. There's 89 in MPO, so there should still be some decent. There's 387 players registered. There's still 30 MPO spots available because you can have 120 people in MPO.
All right, if you're listening,
MA1 is full.
Yeah, if you're listening and you want a nice challenge at New London, the week before Lake Marshall, bow for Bedford, baby.
Heck yeah! But they're doing these wraparound events, and one of them is in Florida, and from what I've heard from like interviews and stuff, it seemed like the idea is eventually like, why isn't there tour events going on in December? Like there's not really a true need for a full off season in disc golf. Like golf's already kicked up the next season. So that's kind of what I've heard is you basically are going to be
off season so bad.
Well, but I think it'd be like you would be able to more pick and choose throughout the year. So you're not traveling for these long stretches. Like there'd be, I think it would eventually get to where
that would be nice if they don't.
I think it'd get to where like there's the Ledgestones, the D-Glows, the Des Moines, the like top tier that you know, hey, everyone's at this event, right? But then some guys wouldn't show up to, like, let's say Throw Down the Mountain became a Pro Tour event. Like, it might be like, well, some guys aren't showing up to Throw Down the Mountain, to where like it's still a full on Pro Tour event, but it's not as full of a field. If that makes sense. Because like that's from my experience, that's kind of what happens in golf. It's like there's some tour events, but it's like, of course, someone random won because like no one was there. But still a tour event.
I think the interesting thing would be, because right now, every Elite Series was pretty much the strength of field at Elite Series is pretty much as high as it could possibly be.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I don't really know. There's not really an Elite Series off that tops comes off to my top of my head. I was like, oh yeah, people missed this one. Like people just didn't go. Like pretty much everyone went to every Elite Series. I think they'd be hard right now too to like make an Elite Series to where not most people don't want to go. So I feel like if you're going to add an event, because the thing you don't want to have happen is you don't want to have an event that you're basically forcing players to have to play because of the points.
Yeah.
Right. And like, if you make an event, an Elite Series of where the points are going to be 100%, you're basically forcing, because there's not that many of them. You're basically forcing, because I think
that's the idea.
There was 13 and 11 eight count, right?
Or 11 count. So is I think that
eight
would
or 11.
Well, that would kind of be the idea. Is like, let's say it is 11, and let's say it stays 11, but now there's 20 tour events. If you're someone who is like, if you're a top 10 player, you can pick your 15 events, not play five, and know you're going to get the same amount of points as if you play all 20. Mm-hmm. So it gives options to like lower level players that are just grinding on tour. Yeah, you can go play all 20 tour events.
It's eight finishes at 12 tour stops and three finishes at eight silver series.
Yeah. So like, let's say it stayed at eight, but now there's 18 tour stops. To where there are some going on in November and December, you know what I mean? But now people would be much more selective and be like, you know what? Yeah, it sounds great to keep my tour going and be in Florida in December. And other people would be like, no, I want a true off season. I'm picking my season up in February, March, whatever.
Do you want that though right now in disc golf of where you have like these fractured fields?
Right now, no. Right
Silver
now, no.
Series, yeah, because I was going to say Silver Series obviously gets way less. As the season went on, we saw a trend of more and more top players not playing in Silver Series.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. And, you know, Belton, I think a lot of people were paying attention to Belton. I think a lot of people were paying attention to Beaver State Fling, which was not a Silver Series. So I don't know why said that one. Was Beaver State Fling a Silver Series?
Or no, are you
was
saying it was
really?
An Elite Series?
Yeah, it wasn't Silver. Or sorry, it... Yeah, I'm.
Are you
I'm
saying
trying...
it wasn't a PD? Wasn't a Pro Tour or wasn't?
No, I think it was Elite Series. I don't think it was Silver. I think it was
no,
an Elite
it was
Series
a Silver
event.
Series. Yeah, it was Silver Series.
Beaver State Fling was Silver.
Yeah,
okay.
Portland opens the Pro Tour.
Yeah, so the way that Beaver State Fling and Belton were set up is like pretty much everyone was there. So like those got treated like an Elite Series, in my opinion, as far as. People tuning in. Now obviously coverage is different for Silver Series and Elite Series, but my point being, do we want more tournaments that are like fractured of where you're getting a much smaller population of the top players going, because now you're adding so many mini. I don't think we're there yet.
No, but I think it's good to be headed that direction. I think it's good to start implementing stuff now. Like, I think it'd be fine to have some more Silver Series wraparound events where the top guys know there's no point to play these, but the like lower guys are like, hey, you know, I need to still be making a living this off season, and it'd be great to get some points. I can play these Silver Series. I think it's much like what the Pro Tour does in general. I think it's a very slow play where they're like the tour cards. They're very slowly introducing these things. Like, now they're doing Silver Series wraparound events where... 5-6 years from now, yeah, it might be good to have just like there's a tour event going on every other weekend of the year, but not all of them are full field. I think, you know, because also this is actually something I wanted to bring up. They also probably are thinking right now, Disc Golf Network is a big revenue driver, which the numbers actually recently came out or
40,000 subscribers.
Yeah, very impressive stuff. In my opinion, I mean, that, am I wrong? 40,000 subscribers. That seems way bigger than I would have thought it was.
I want to say they passed 20,000 the first year I was playing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
So they've doubled the last 2 years, which is pretty good. I think.
I was just thinking like 40,000, I did the math, and if all 40,000 were PDGA members, so all 40,000 were getting 50% off. Unlikely. I'm sure people are paying the full amount, but if everyone was, it's like 2.8 million in revenue a year estimate for the Pro Tour off of just Disc Golf Network, just paid subscribers. So that doesn't include the advertising, doesn't include anything they're making money off their merch sales, day of spectators, stuff like that. But if I'm the Pro Tour, I'm thinking, hey, the off season hits, October hits, I'm sure their subscriber number is going to go down. They can offer off season content, right? They're doing this like reality show on tour. They're doing stuff like that. But if they're like, hey, we could throw in three Silver Series and now people have a little bit more of a reason. As long as people are subscribed, you don't have to give them nearly as much of a reason to stay subscribed as you do getting someone to subscribe. So if I'm like, if I'm a fan and I'm sitting there and I'm like, I could cancel it, but there's going to be four Silver Series this off season before, you know, the season kicks back up. I might as well just keep it and watch. I mean, I'm paying $6 a month. Why not? I don't know. I could definitely see where that, and also now you have more advertising spots to sell. So like revenue wise, I can definitely see where the Pro Tour would be like, hey, why do we have this dead spot when like there's not really a reason for there to be this big dead spot in our sport? From like, people are still playing disc golf. It's not like when the pro tour, when the pro season ends after tour championship, that everyone in the country just stops playing disc golf. People are still playing, so why not have the pros still play? I can see that line of thought very easily.
Should we do a little 180 real quick and go back to Maple Hill and just talk a little bit about, because I feel like we didn't talk anything about results and just kind of how stuff panned out a little bit.
Yeah, we can finish it with that.
Because I think on both sides, very, very interesting. Obviously, one being more polarizing than the other. And I think this is where it's like, it's definitely an interesting thing, because you hear, I feel like when you go from niche sport to niche sport, when you bounce around as much as I have, it's, you hear the same things all the time. So I think it's very common for people to kind of, I don't know, obviously everyone wants to build their sport up, but I think sometimes when you are like more of a niche sport where you're not getting the national attention, you're not on ESPN and SportsCenter and NBC and getting the national exposure, I think sometimes it's easy to kind of hype it up a little bit more. And so you hear like, our sport has the best people, we have the best fans, we're the nicest, we're so, and I think this week, you know, I think it kind of opens the door a little bit to see how like, yeah, every sport has people that suck. Like there's just, you know, unfortunately the way the world is right now, there's just a lot of bad, mean, terrible people out there, and every sport's going to have people like that sprinkled in. Cause I guess we'll start on the FPO side. We've already talked about our opinions and thoughts on the, situation of like whether or not Natalie Ryan should be allowed to play. We've already discussed that in the past. So if you want to go back and listen to that, that's fine. But as of right now, she is abiding by all the rules that are set forth. So she hasn't done anything to not be able to play in the FPO. So my first thing about like how people are obviously just going to spin it however they want, I think that was just an eye opener for people being like, wait, our sport actually does have people in it that aren't the nicest. Cause obviously the comments and stuff like that were running rampant on social media, and you know, we'll see if something happens in the off season, as far as the Disc Golf Pro Tour looking into rule changes or the PDGA looking to rule changes or whatnot. But as of right now, there's no rules being broken, essentially. So with that being said, just looking at the actual competition of the FPO, and we'll just kind of run through it. The first 2 days for FPO were just some of the worst scoring conditions you could possibly have. You know, round one was so bad we didn't even play on MPO. You know, the course was, by the time they got the course ready and stuff for FPO to go back out there, it was too late in the day, and there was no way that we would have been able to get out and actually play our rounds. So round one and round two was, I think, was interesting to kind of see how the leaderboard shook out, because I think it ended up bringing a lot of people, because when the weather gets really bad, look at like DDO this year, when the weather gets really, really bad, it makes it to where like the score separation is so small, mm-hmm. because a lot of people are in these, in those situations are just playing for par.
Yeah.
So you don't have the people playing for birdie and getting bogeys anymore. You just have people just trying to stay and get pars. Birdies are almost like, for us, even round two, like there were a handful of holes that were just like unbirdieable. Like you just could not birdie them.
Yeah.
So that ends up, again, also making the scoring separation shrink, because now instead of having 14 holes that you can birdie, par, bogey, double, you now only have 14 holes, right? So FPO was a pretty, from the stuff I watched, was a pretty exciting tournament, right?
Yeah.
You had the, going into the tournament, you had the big storylines of like what's going on with Paige, right? And you know, her press conference was, I don't know if you guys talked about it on Grip Locked, but her press conference was interesting, to say the least. And I've talked about this before, of how, you know, if disc golf was nationally, not broadcasted, nationally covered, if you will, right? So you had blogs talking about it. You had all the sports networks talking about it. You know, I think some of these press conferences would get blown up a little bit more, because you would have, you know, I think sometimes when you just watch it, you can, or you might, if you're 50-50 watching it or whatnot, right? You're kind of paying attention, but not really. Sometimes stuff kind of can get just said and swept under the rug and you don't pay attention to it. Where like if you had 15, 20 different reporters all there and like stuff was said at these press conferences, they would be taking sound bites back. They would be posting stuff on social. And some of that was happening, but it was happening from like fans. It wasn't actually happening from any sort of, I'm sure you guys covered it a little bit. So that there's one media outlet. I don't know if like AltiWorld covered it or who else is really covering disc golf? There's really not that much outside of like the pro tour themselves. But yeah, I mean, I thought that was very interesting. And, you know, going into the tournament, if I would have had a bet whether or not Paige would be in contention after hearing that, I would have probably said not, because it sounded like she was just like packed up and like ready to be done with the season. So I was very surprised and very impressed with her play down the stretch. Because she kind of looked like, you know, what people have been saying, like, where's the old Paige? She kind of looked like old Paige, of where she's in the hunt, she's in contention, she's putting the pressure on.
Yeah. Well, we questioned on Grip Locked was how much of what she said was how she truly felt, and how much was it she just, it'd been a little bit since she had the taste of being in contention, being in the chase. Because, like, I think to me, what happened was, she realized, oh, this, I can win this thing. And then it's very easy to go straight back to, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to win. That's where my mindset went. It's like, I called it on Grip Locked, and some people were calling me out on this. I'm sticking by it. What I saw was like when I would beat my older brother in like basketball or something, and my older brother would be like, yeah, but you know, I wasn't even trying. Like, you know, like, of course you beat me. I lost my killer instinct. I don't even really want it back, to be honest with you. That's kind of what I got, where it's like, no, I beat you fair and square, Jimmy. Come on. And he's like, nah, but, you know, I wasn't even trying, man. You know what I'm saying? That's what I was seeing. I could be completely off base on that. Just my outside perspective on it.
So, hey, bud. Hey, mom's not up yet. Okay, all right. You're fine. Schmeller's out here saying hello. Some of the stuff, and again, like, I think if you go through these, you know, if you go through these press conferences, there was that Ricky one where he was talking about how Worlds all of a sudden is not that important anymore. And it's like, does he say that if he wins his third time?
Did you see the tweet?
What was the tweet?
Oh, you keep going. I'll pull up his tweet.
Okay.
That he sent. He kind of doubled down on it. It was pretty funny.
The Paige one was interesting because she was saying how she was like, yeah, I just like don't get upset anymore. And if you have him watching FPO, she was 100%. Like she wasn't, she was very happy-go-lucky, always smiling, but she was like well out of contention at that point.
Yeah.
If you watch this coverage, she was getting upset at herself. She was still smacking her disc. She was, and so this notion of like, yeah, I'm just, I think you're right in the sense of where it's like, once you get back into it of where you're like, holy crap, I can win again. Like that killer instinct comes back. Like you, it's a lot easier to be happy-go-lucky when you're 10 shots back. And I would even say like, she probably wasn't even very happy-go-lucky when she was that round that she had going into GMC where she knew she had to play well to make the cut.
Yeah.
Like, I think there is a part of where I'm like, we don't have a lot of media coverage, right? But there also, the downside to that as well is a lot of times, like, there's only a couple stories that are told and talked about. And so, like, the thing that she's probably been hearing all season is Kristen Starr is the best. Kristen Starr is the best. And, like, that's, like, the storyline that's just pushed down to everyone's throat. Like, and I'm sure that probably gets old over the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, with you, it kind of sucks now that we don't really have that many events because the Tour Championship, the way it is set up, it's very awkward, right? Like, it's a very weird setup. And Throw Pink, I guess, I wish there was more. We talked about this. I wish there was more put behind the Throw Pink, but it not being a major takes away a little bit. But it will be interesting. That will be the last tournament we kind of see going into the off season. Of where Paige, she looked like she got that taste back, and it'll be interesting to see kind of how she goes into that tournament. Cause that is another mentally, you know, we're not playing on golf courses of where you can kind of just free willy throw and do whatever. And there's not really any stress. Like Winthrop is a very stressful course. MVP is a very stressful course. GMC is a very stressful, two courses. So it'll be interesting to see kind of, you know, if we get that page back and hopefully we do, because I do think obviously FPO is a lot more exciting when she's in the picture and when she's competing at the top than when she, and that to me is the thing is like, as a spectator and stuff, the last thing I want to hear is someone coming out and saying they don't care. Exactly. Like that's the it's so hard for me to want to root for someone when I feel like I care more about them doing good or bad than they even care.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think you might be right in the sense of like, I don't know if that's how she truly feels. And maybe I don't think Trevor's gotten her on his show yet. Has he?
I don't think so. No,
that'd be a good interview to pull because, it'd be interesting to catch and kind of hear exactly. I don't know if she would open up a little bit because I always got the mindset like she's one of the more competitive people on tour.
Yeah.
And she because you hear this too of where, you know, people say about Paul, people say about Ricky of like, oh, well, if they have no chance of winning, they just don't care. And it's like, I don't know, man. Like if I'm a competitor, I'm competing, whether I'm trying to get a top, you know, if I'm out of the contention of winning, right? I'm 5 shots back or 10, let's say 10 shots back going into hole, going to round the final round. I know I have no chance of winning, right? Like there's now a secondary goal that I set. My primary goal was to win the tournament. Now as a competitor, I don't have a chance of doing that. I played myself out of it. I now have to reset a goal.
Yeah.
Right. And so my goal now is like, I want to get a top 10 and that's what I'm fighting for. Like, it's hard for me to believe that if you are a competitive person, that all of a sudden you can just like switch that on and off. You hear, and we've never, I don't know if we've actually heard it from those guys themselves of saying like, yeah, if I have no chance of winning, I could care less of whether I get 40 out of cash or in cash. Like we've heard Sexton talk about how important his cash streak is, right?
Yeah.
So like he's brought that up of where, yeah, even if I have no chance of winning, like me keeping that cash streak going, like that competitive edge. I feel like Paige is in that same ball game of where I would assume, like, even if she has no chance of winning after round three and she's completely out of it, going into that round four, I would like to believe as a fan that she's still fighting tooth and nail for every shot and trying to finish as high up on the leaderboard as possible. Because, I mean, we've seen in every other sport when someone shows disinterest, like Brooks Koepka is a perfect example of some, he lost a lot of fans, I feel like, when he had those press conferences talking about like how he doesn't care, he doesn't practice, he just shows up, whatever. Like, I don't know if a lot of people, it's hard to get behind someone like that.
Yeah.
And I'm with you in the sense of like, I don't know if that's really how Paige felt or if she just kind of felt like she was boxed into a corner and that was her way out.
Yeah.
What was Ricky's thing?
Yeah. So Ricky's tweet, I pulled it up. It was after he won the points champion. He said, "You're 2022 Disc Golf Pro Tour points champion. This title means more than any title to me as a player. I'm always striving for consistency at the top and this shows that."
Yeah. See, like my guess is in his contract. My guess is his bonuses is probably a lot different. His bonus structure is probably a lot different for being the points leader to being a world champion would be my guess.
I would agree. Yeah. Probably way less for the points champion. I don't even know if there's gotta be some type of bonus for a points champion.
Who won points champion last year?
Was it Rick?
Yep. Again? My point. Nope. That's my point.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
my
I have
point.
No idea. I have no idea.
That's my point. That's my no point. Clue. It's not something that, and here's the thing. He very well could be telling the truth of where it means more to him.
Yeah.
Like I can't say that's incorrect. Like if that's how he truly feels, but I can tell you how people feel. People don't care.
No. Yeah. People know the world champion. And that's why people don't care. Needs to be restructured because the tour, especially because like you asked me the tour champion last year, Nate Queen, you know that. Right, points champion, it just doesn't like it doesn't get highlighted. There's the trophy presentation No. that happened at MVP, and we won't talk about it really again because then we'll hear player of the year will be the next thing given, and then there's the world champion, player of the year, tour points champion, or tour champion.
Even player of the year is something that doesn't really get that much.
No, it doesn't either. It doesn't either. So
you know, like you don't really hear too much about it. Oh, careful. Going back to the press conferences a little bit. Hold on. We got feeding time right now, so the dogs are just kind of all over the place. So going back a little bit to the press conferences, there was so obviously that was a big storyline on the FPO side was Paige, you know, and she showed out this week, played her way into contention. And honestly, like it was almost one of those scenarios where very similar to MPO, how MPO played out of where I was like, is like Kristen and like, is it going to be one of those situations where they both like Kristen and Natalie both try to win it on 18 and they both come up short and then Paige just wins. Like
yeah,
that was a scenario that could have easily happened. So, but the other storyline coming into it was Kona of was she going to qualify for the tour championship? Because she was just on the outside looking in. And, you know, she's another person where, again, with how media is, there's just not that many media outlets out there. So, like, everyone's just hammering one point over and over and over again. And she's been, you know, a topic of discussion all season. You know, I think she handled herself the best she could, because it has obviously been a tough season, and the way that FPO is shaking out as well is similar to MPO of where more and more people are starting to tour. So what also is happening is on MPO, some of the reason why like a Nate Sexton cash streak might not ever exist on MPO again, because in the past we would have fields of like 130 people, but there would be like 40 or 50 people that had no chance of cashing.
Yeah.
But because we have 130, that juices up the amount of people that cash, right? So that cash number is like what, 70 or 80 people cash or something? Not 80. It'd probably be like 65.
70. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's only 80 people that can actually cash. So yeah, you're only fighting 15 people for cash, essentially. Where you look at like a Maple Hill, there was 88 people, 82, 80, somewhere in the 80s, and 30 people cashed.
Yeah.
And there might have been like 5 to 7 people that could not cash. So now you have essentially, you have 80 people vying for 30 spots. So yeah, there are 50 people that are decent enough to cash that will not cash at Maple Hill. So like we talked about how GMC was probably the hardest tournament to cash at. Maple Hill just beat that as yeah, now the Maple Hill was the hardest tournament ever in disc golf history to cash at. And I think that you're seeing that a little bit on the FPO side of where some of the top players, you know, you look at Paige, outside of Kristen, really, you look at any of the top players and their finishing this year is way more variable than last year.
Yeah.
Right? Like people are jumping outside the top 10 where they used to never jump outside the top 10. And we even had like, we also had like Heather Young didn't have a full tour, and she's super competitive when the courses suit her game. Haley King is arguably one of the best players. She barely toured this year. So you still have like some top players that even tour. So, you know, it's easy. It's much easier this year to not have the finishes that you were looking for, or to, if you just compared this year to last year, you know, I was doing the same thing. Like, I was like, dang, like, yeah, I had some top finishes this year, but I also had some like really bad finishes. But if you like look at who's beating you and stuff like that, you know, finishing 30th or 35th last year is probably like finishing, you know, like if you got 35th last year, you're probably getting like 50 something this year, 60.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree.
Just because there's just so many more people.
There's so many more people touring right now. And those people who, even the people who have been touring, have started, I don't want to say taking it more seriously, but I think that's what I mean by it.
They definitely have.
I don't want to downplay how serious they were taking it before, but I think with the money going in and stuff, it's gotten more serious to where there's a lot of players who were notable names previously, but they're getting a lot better because it's like, oh, shoot, this is legit. Like if I push from being a top 30 player to a top 15 player, the amount of money I'm going to make is drastically different. And I think that's the type of stuff that's been happening to where the field's not only getting bigger, but it's getting so much deeper as well.
Here's three things that I saw change this year on tour. One, way more players out there at practice rounds and earlier. So you, last year, you really, the course really only was getting full the day before the tournament. Now, 2 days before the tournament, the course is pretty full. And then also on top of that, a lot more structured and serious practice rounds. Before, there would be, you know, 5, 6, 7 people going out and just having like a casual round.
Yeah.
Sometimes that still happens. Obviously, the Pro Tour has also done a good job of like eliminating that, because that does slow down pace of play a lot for practice rounds. But you're seeing a lot more like twosomes going out, threesomes going out, foursomes going out, and getting like good practice in versus it being like more of just a casual fun round.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I would see is like, I mean, after tournaments last year, if I went and threw more on the range or went and putted more after my round, like it was me. I would rarely ever see anyone else. And this year, I'm starting to see more and more people on the putting green, on the driving range after rounds, of where people are now putting in more work. They just got done with their round. Something wasn't right. Their step putt was off. Their release on their forehand was off. And instead of just being like, well, hopefully tomorrow it works, they are now going and trying to figure it out going into tomorrow. So, yeah. To say, at the very least, people are taking it way more seriously. And I think you see that in the byproduct of the competition. You know, you don't know you know, this week it was Thomas Gilbert and Raven Newsom. I could be missing out maybe on someone else on the NPO side, but like
Linus Carlson. I mean, he was someone.
Oh, Linus too. Linus too. Yeah. You don't know who's going to pop off. You don't know whose week it's going to be. And that used to not be the case. And it's so exciting now to kind of see that. And yeah, I mean, so FPO, how it played out. Was I surprised no one went for the birdie on 18? Not really, because that kind of eliminated Paige from the equation. And I don't know if that was in the back of their heads at all, of like, if we just both par this hole, Paige is out of the tiebreaker, and that's nice. If that was their strategy, I would say that was a smart one, because I do not think I would want to see Paige in a playoff in that scenario.
Yeah.
So I think that was smart in the sense of them eliminating Paige from the equation. And yeah, I mean, Kristen clearly, I'll say this, watching Kristen play this week, she did not have her A game by any means.
No. Yeah.
And this is kind of what we talked about with her, is right now she is so above and beyond the field of the only way someone can catch her or can be competitive is if she has a bad week. And she did. She was missing putts all over the place.
She like turfed both her shots on 18, it seemed like. Her drive.
Yeah, her forehand did not look good.
No.
I don't know what she was missing, like lots of gaps.
Yeah.
Lots of just early releasing. I don't know what was happening. It was just an off week for her, but that kind of just shows how incredible of a player she is right now, based off the FPO field, is her off week, she can still win.
Yeah.
Which is wild. But yeah, it turned out Natalie now has two Elite Series victories of the year, which I think she joins what? She joins Kristen and Paige as the only people with multiple. Does Kat have multiple? Or is
I don't
Kat
think Kat does. I'll
I was trying to remember. I was trying to remember. Kat's season's kind of been a weird one, because I feel like she was super in contention beginning of the season, and has lost a little bit of mojo here towards the end.
Kat has Vegas and Idlewild. So she does have two.
Okay, so Kat does have two.
They're just very far apart.
Yep. All right, so those four have... Valerie only has Waco, right? She didn't win another one?
She won Portland.
So Valerie has two.
Valerie Mandahano, because I believe she went undefeated in Portland. She won Waco,
dang, so there's a,
Portland.
So there's a handful. Yeah, so there's a handful of people. Okay, so... I'm probably going to think of another person, too, that has two. Probably
I don't
not.
Think there's any
maybe
others.
I will.
I don't think there's any others. But wouldn't surprise me if you said someone, I looked it up, and I was like, oh, there it is. Yep,
yeah.
There's another one.
Yeah, they have two.
No, well,
yep.
This was a big parity year for FPO. There was a lot. I think big. Part of it was Kristen wasn't there the whole year. She
That's
had that
huge.
Middle stretch. That was a big one. And Paige, previous years, that scared me. Previous years, Paige has been Kristen. Paige has been in that shoot where... if Paige has a bad weekend, she still's winning. That mm-hmm. is not the case this year. It was only Kristen in that shoe. If you had Kristen, Paige, Kat all on that level where, like, even if they don't show up, they're still going to win, part of that is the Paige and Kat gap the field caught up to
yes.
a little bit. That's a big part of it. But then the other part, too, is, I mean, they just didn't – I don't know what fully went on, but – there was just some events where they just, it wasn't even a bad weekend. They just like might as well not have been there. There were some events for Paige and Kat where like Kristen, her bad weekend, she was still putting together good shots. Like she was still able to do stuff. There are some weekends for Paige and Kat where it's like, you're not even playing disc golf right now. What's going on?
Yeah.
And that just didn't happen for Kristen. But yeah, and it was a big year for FPO parity wise. And I think it's only going to get deeper next year. And the year after that, and the year after that, I think that's the trend now.
And this, honestly, we keep talking about it. We like live coverage is the future of disc golf.
Absolutely.
And more of these tournaments are panning out to where, again, not a knock on Jomez or Central Coast or GK Pro, not a knock on them at all. But if that's how you're consuming tournament coverage now, you are missing so much. You're missing the big picture. Because,
well, like, look at MPO. We didn't talk about them both quite yet, but MPO, yeah, we're the winner, going came, to MPO in winner second. Came from Chase Card. So, like, if you're watching Joe,
no, it wasn't even Chase, I thought. Wasn't
I'm pretty
it
sure,
third?
I'm pretty sure Simon was on Chase. Yeah. But there was a point where Paul was pushing from third, and Paul was like,
Paul was
for the
pushing
lead.
From third.
Yeah,
that's
you had,
what it was. Okay.
You had a big context of Paul and Ricky were charging. Paul, at one point, was in the lead. Simon starts charging. Corey Ellis is falling apart at the beginning. Corey Ellis starts coming back. There was a point late in the round, like hole 14, 15 for lead card, that there was like five or six guys that you're like, if this stuff happens, they could win.
Yeah, I was like, oh, Linus is going to take this. I was like, Linus is about to win this whole tournament.
And then next thing you know, like going into the final hole, you had Simon, Corey, and Linus all right there, all tied up going into 18.
And FPO was the same thing of where if you're watching live, you're seeing Paige just climb up the leaderboard. And Kristen and Natalie were kind of just like at a, they weren't really doing much. And then they kind of brought it on late. And so, yeah, the back and forth is just the pacing is so much better for live than trying to recreate that for post. And, the MPO side, talking about it, you know, I think, you know, Thomas kind of shot himself out on the front nine, so he was kind of out of the equation.
I thought Corey I thought Corey was done. He was 3-over through 7. I didn't think he was going to be able to just – I didn't think he'd be able to get himself back together more so. Like, I knew he wasn't officially out of it, but the way he was playing, it didn't look good. It didn't look like someone who's going to be able to just, like, gather himself and get back in this thing, which he did.
I think for him, if I pull up his scorecard real quick, I think the thing that was very beneficial for him is how the course plays out. Hole 8, 9, and 10 are all very birdieable holes, especially for his skill set.
Yeah.
And so, like, hole 8, he was able to just throw one good shot, birdie. Hole 9, you throw one good tee shot, it's pretty much a birdie on that par 4. And then hole 10 is just a power hyzer. Pure power hyzer shot, which is right up his alley. So I think those three holes coming at that kind of midway point of where he was kind of like on that precipice of like, where am I going? I think that was huge for him to be able to get all three of those to get the momentum going. Cause then he just birdied 5 of the last 8 holes coming in.
Yeah.
To really put himself in. And arguably should have probably birdied 6 of the last 8, right? Probably should have birdied 18.
Definitely.
We can talk about that here in a second. But who was the fourth guy on lead? I'm trying to remember. It was Linus, Gannon, Thomas.
And Gannon, if I would have bet money on hole 14, 15, Gannon was winning. If you'd have put like, Hunter, you have to pick a winner right now, I would have chose Gannon 100%.
Yeah, hole 16.
8 is lunch.
Hole 16, it'll be interesting to see what they do with that hole because I didn't see his tee shot. Did his tee shot go OB or did his second shot go OB?
His tee shot kicked way left, I believe. But yeah, which is OB. It kicked way OB, yeah.
Yeah. Now, obviously, if you for his tee shot to go OB, you have to throw a bad shot. You have to not hit the gap. But you can kind of still – there's two late trees on the right. It'll be interesting to see if they keep those in or not. But with how difficult of a hole that is, you know, it's one of those of where there are some people that are kind of like throwing their shots over on the right-hand side and kind of getting lucky backdoor. And if you take those two trees out, then it's like, okay, anyone that hits the initial 300-foot gap are all going to basically get the same results versus some are going to get good results and some aren't. But with that OB left there, like my play always on that hole was like, let me get something out of my hand that is immediately starting to move right. So that way, if it does end up hitting left, like the left side of a tree, it's going to be on like an ante line, which is going to try to keep it going right.
Yeah.
Versus if you release something flat or on hyzer and it hits the left side of the tree, it's going to more redirect it left, which... You're also, I don't know if, I mean, you haven't played the course, but I don't know if it I don't know if it translated well to coverage, but we're throwing like through a gap that's like up on a hill. So if you do hit a tree and it starts going left, it's working downhill.
Yeah.
So there's a real, it gives a real possibility for a really, really long tree kick because it can just kind of float down all the way. So
yeah.
So that's a tough one for him because he could have easily kind of parred that hole and birdied out. And I don't know what that would have put him in, but I think that would have put him in contention at least.
Because he did birdie out. He birdied 17 and 18. And if he just took a three on 16, he would have tied with Simon at 16 under.
Okay, so then him and Simon are in a playoff. Dang.
Yeah.
So let's go into hole 18 because that's really where this tournament kind of all got decided. That tree kick on hole one the tree kick on the first shot for Linus was like,
it was brutal.
That tree's in your way too. Like, and my only thought is like, he's playing that for birdie. That's my only thought. Now, what I'll say too with this is he is someone that is a flat to Annie release thrower. And with how that hole is shaped, he has to push that tree on the left.
Yeah.
To be able to make it past that tree in the fairway. If he was able to release on hyzer, similar to like Corey Ellis, how Corey Ellis is more of a hyzer release to flip up, that gap opens up a whole lot more.
Yeah.
And so you were able to see Corey get really, really aggressive on his tee shot where Linus, it's much harder for him. Now, what do we feel about his second shot there?
I mean, obviously the way it turned out sucked, but I understand. I mean, where he was at, he was thinking with how good Corey's drive was, I've got to be in a place I can throw this in. So I think he's just going with whatever he felt got him as far up and in a position to throw in as he could. And so if that's the backhand roller for him, I don't hate it. Because it was a very, very aggressive play.
That was the only question mark I had was the spot. Obviously he was in off the tee wasn't ideal, but he was still in a spot to where four is a pretty feasible spot. And that at least puts him in the equation to tie Simon, right?
Yeah.
And puts all the pressure now on Corey because
I think he's thinking par loses it, which with Corey's drive, I'd be thinking that.
Too. I know, but I mean, of course, you're thinking
that. But Corey was 160 feet out. Like, yes, it's a tough up and down, it's a very tight green, all the pressure. But with how Corey been playing down that stretch, I mean, he was on a four birdie in a row streak. How he's playing down that stretch. As a player, I don't feel like you're thinking he's missing a 160 foot upshot. I'm not betting on that. I'd much rather
Let's do the numbers.
Aggressive.
Let's do the numbers. What is more likely? What is more likely that Corey pars from there, or that Linus throws some shot to then throws in his third shot? I think that's what you have to do in your head.
Yeah.
Like Corey parring from there is probably like 20 or not parring. Sorry. Not getting birdie. Right. Because
if you don't get birdie, he was bogeying from where he's at. Basically.
Most likely. I mean, there's a chance he throws like not the greatest upshot and gets on the island somehow and misses a 30 footer. There's a chance for that. There's also a chance for him that he clears the island and then makes the drop zone putt. We saw multiple people do that. So there, I think I'm just running the numbers, and that's where I don't know if Linus had a caddy, but I think that's something where a caddy is super beneficial because if I'm on his bag, I'm telling him, listen, man, like the chances of you birding from here, like of you throwing some shot to get you way up there and then throwing in like that green is pretty covered too. You have to be like way left to even have a chance to like have a backhand throw in. I did see Bradley Williams do it. It was very impressive. He finished out incredible too that back nine. But I think I'm telling him, hey man, let's just chip something up. Let's get on the green, take our par, and let's see where the chips crumble there. Because I just think that percentage play is so much higher of playing for par than trying to get birdie.
Yeah.
In that scenario, and thinking that Corey Ellis is guaranteed a birdie. Now, obviously, this is way easier to all talk about in hindsight. Now, going to Corey Ellis, let's switch to Corey Ellis now. Great tournament by Linus also, and that his points also there, I think, also brought him from the play-in to qualified.
Yes.
Which is super impressive because I don't even know how many.
Outside the play-in, he jumped up 11 spots.
Like, how many tournaments did he play in? Like, I don't even think he played. Like, that's very impressive that he qualified for the Tour Championship with the amount of tournaments he played.
Yeah.
And that just has to do with, like, you know, how good he is at his ceiling, right? Like, when he's on, he has shown that he can finish there with the top of them. So, great tournament from Linus. Congratulations to him. Let's move to Corey real quick. So, how much do you think the I've already gotten this close and have lost in a playoff earlier this season, how much do you think that was playing into leading up to that shot?
I don't know how much that was in the back of his mind as, I mean, wanting to win a Pro Tour in general and being in a position to, ton of pressure. Maple Hill, one of the more prestigious Pro Tours to win, ton of pressure. Then you're staring at Simon, who's waiting for you, and that whole crowd.
I don't think Simon was in view, but continue. He wasn't, yeah. I know what you're saying.
Yeah, but
I know, figuratively, you're staring at Simon. Yeah. Yes. So I just want to make sure people don't think Simon was like standing behind the basket, standing, being like
looking at him,
like staring at him. Yeah,
that's what's in my head. Personally, that's the pressure I'm feeling. I'm not really thinking about D-Glow, but it is something like, I would almost think D-Glow gives me confidence of like, I've put myself in a playoff before, I can do this again. You know what I mean?
Like, D-Glow's a little bit different though, right? Because D-Glow was a scenario where he had a birdie 18 to put himself in a playoff.
Yeah. This is birdie 18 to win.
This is a scenario of where he's thinking in his head, if I just lay up and pitch over, because this is, again, this is why I think this hole is so good. And this is also where it's like, why can't we have more holes like this? We need more holes like this, not just hole 18. We need holes like this across the board because from 177 feet, he is having to make a decision. Hole one is another one. Hole one on Maple Hill. People were making decisions from spots where you're just like, what the heck? Like, you would never think, if I told you this guy, he's a top 20 player in the world, laid up from 280 feet.
Yeah.
You would be like, what? No way. People were doing it all over the place because they know the ramifications of like, if I mess up the shot, I'm taking a bogey. And that's where, like, in no world does anyone get nervous or feel like they're not going to get up and down from 177 feet. Except in that scenario, he knows if I don't throw this on,
yeah,
there is a really high chance I take bogey and I go from a playoff to losing. So like that thought now, it's no longer, that's why I think it's different than D-Glow, because D-Glow was like, I have to birdie.
Yeah.
He doesn't birdie, who cares? This scenario, like, he knows in his head, I can easily jump putt, tap in, and we're going to 18. Now, what I think Nate Sexton said, I think was dead on. Where he was basically saying, if you take this into a playoff, you are not going to have a better drive than what you had right now.
Correct.
Now, the only counter argument I would have, and this is kind of, again, a little bit like of the coach quarterback, Simon did not play hole 18 well, all tournament. And you could hear it too. As soon as he threw that shot, and he got super lucky, right? It was going OB right, got a good kick to kind of kick him back in the fairway. He said something that kind of made you lead to the belief like that tee shot had been really causing him problems.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if Corey knew that or not, but like that would be like the rolling the dice, right? Of like, Simon is struggling on this hole. Let's go to hole 18 and force him to have to throw this good tee shot.
But... What?
But I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like that would be the only other thing.
But more than likely, Simon's going to force you to birdie 18 to beat him. More than likely.
Not if he throws his first shot OB.
Not if he goes OB. But if he pars, which he parred the final round with a good lucky kick. Simon parred whole round two, and round one, he bogeyed. So he played it one over.
I'm telling you, he was not playing that. I'm telling you, that tee shot, he said something when he got off that. When he threw that tee shot on 18, he said something that led me like that. Now, again, Corey doesn't have the benefit of hearing that.
No.
But
I'm just
like, if he did, that led me to believe like that guy does not want to throw a hole 18 again. He does not want to throw that tee shot.
No. I'm just saying, if I'm Corey, I'm sitting there thinking I'm going to have to birdie to win in the playoff anyways.
Yes. And so that's why I said Sexton's. Yes.
I'm here. I'm not going to have an easier birdie than this right now.
Correct.
So
that's why I thought Sexton nailed it when he said that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I'm saying like the couch quarterback of where like if he knew what I knew.
Yeah. You're also 170 feet out. Like even on that hole, I can definitely see the line of thought of being like it's a
to be fair though. He did almost make the putt. He did almost make the putt
from the drop zone.
So like makes you
even
longer than the drop zone. So it makes you believe, like makes you think, like man, if he would have just laid up, he still could have won without the risk of losing.
Definitely could have.
But yes, I see what you're saying.
He's getting up and down. No pressure, no anything. It's probably 80-90%. He's getting up and down from that spot.
I think it's higher. I think it's higher than 90.
But that's the point. It's like no pressure, no anything. That's a shot that like a player like him is not messing up. And so when you're standing up to it, you got to just be like, oh, easy, I'm going for it. And then obviously what happened, it seemed like adrenaline just got to him. Because I think he pulled it a little bit, but more than anything, he juiced that.
No, he just threw it too hard. He didn't pull it at all. The line was perfect. He just threw it too hard. I think, again, this is why I'll say Sexton is the best commentator we have. Sexton needs like whatever the Pro Tour needs to do to make sure that when Sexton is retired and done to get him on live as much as possible, you got to do it because he not only has a great way with words, but he also knows exactly what players are going through. And obviously Nate Doss is there as well. I think Sexton does a little bit better job of being able to describe it better, if you will.
Yeah.
But like exactly what Nate was saying is 100% exactly what would happen. When you're in that scenario, you just feel like your arm goes numb. Like the nerves make it to where it just feels like you don't have anything. And so what you're likely to do is because now you feel like you have nothing in your arm, you're going to juice it because it just, all your touch gets thrown out because it just feels like this disc is going to go nowhere. So you end up juicing it. And that's exactly what happened. Now, the only thing I could think of that could have maybe like helped in that scenario is like throwing like a captain's raptor, throwing something. Cause he went zone, which is the go-to shot in that scenario. But I could see how like maybe you just juice up to a disc that's a little bit faster and more overstable to give you a better chance of maybe digging in there. But again, this is the you know, sitting back quarterback stuff of like, yeah, obviously that might look better now after knowing what we did, but like you kind of have to like
you got to go with what your shot is.
So I feel for him though. I mean, he battled and like you said, like you thought he was out of it. And he showed a lot to battle his way back, getting birdies on some of those very difficult holes coming in down the stretch. And I think he's one of those guys that's going to be in more discussions next year at the top. You know, we're getting more of those people, right? Like I think Isaac Robinson has proven to where his name is in there now in that hat. I mean, you got someone like a James Conrad. Like we haven't talked about him much, but he's in that hat. You got like Kevin Jones. We didn't talk too much about him towards the end of the season, but he's in there as well. We're starting to get lots and lots more people of where it's like, we're not surprised to see them at the top of the leaderboard when they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And for Simon, I mean, that was his fourth Pro Tour win and
player of the year.
Not quite.
Nope. Okay.
I think, well, because Ricky also has four and has a much more consistent year. I think player of the year comes down to USDGC, realistically. If Paul or Simon wins USDGC.
Does that or the tour championship count?
For what? Points or?
When we say player of the year, are we just saying our player of the year, or are we saying the actual player of the year for the PDGA? Because I think the one from the PDGA is stupid.
So I'm saying Pro Tour. I'm not PDGA out the window. Pro Tour and mine both count USDGC.
Pro Tour has its player of the year. Pro Tour actually has a player of the year award.
It's a 25% vote. 25% tour championship finish, 25% tour points, and 25%. What's the fourth? Average finish? We looked up on Griplock. But yeah, they have a player of the year, rookie of the year, most improved, all of that.
USDGC and
the tour championship is very important. It's not important to my personal player of the year because, like, the format
it's weird. Up in the air. It's weird. Yeah.
USDGC is what will determine me, but for the Pro Tour,
that's your final one.
Yeah, because if Paul or Simon win USDGC, I think they surpass Rick. If neither of them win, then I think Ricky's the outright player of the year. If Ricky wins,
They have to win. If Simon gets second and Ricky gets like 15th,
that doesn't help. Well, because Simon's had too many bad finishes. If Paul gets second and Ricky gets like 30th. Maybe
sways
it. But the tough part with Paul is Paul has a major and one Pro Tour, I believe. So if he gets one more major, then he'd have three wins, but two of them majors. That's where
That outweighs four Pro Tours. Yeah. Even though right now the way it's set up, like the field, a major is not any different than. Field strength wise, a major is not really any different than a elite series. We are coming in, like players are coming into that tournament knowing that this matters more.
So absolutely.
So I think you have to take that to
account. So I definitely think USDGC is going to be very exciting. I think that'll be the determining factor for player of the year, in my personal opinion. But I think that wraps it up. Next week we'll talk about Winthrop. You can give us the actual update on the course changes once you play it a little bit. Let us know the weird OBs, how they're all rolling out. And
I'll have stable disc this year. So tell Trevor to watch out.
All right, I'll let him
know. That was a big issue for us last year. Is I was throwing these tour series nukes, not to throw Ezra under the table, but that brown tour series nuke. It was what you know how you said like you don't like nukes because they're too finicky.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, they aren't. If you find the right ones, they aren't. So
it's every disc we have disc some golf, right, man. If you find the right ones,
good ones. And then I have been opened my eyes to the Nuke OS, which is I have a disc that I don't believe you or Hunter or Trevor can throw over 300 feet.
Heck yeah. I can't wait to try.
So we'll see.
Sounds great. All right. Well, best of luck at USDGC, and we'll talk to you all same time, same place next week.